So soil health is the ability to maintain long-term productivity in a very simple sense. But from a soil's perspective, we also want to say, well, a healthy soil also cleans up your water and it reduces toxins and things like that too. So really hard to define. Where we are focusing soil health is what does a healthy soil do to reduce our external inputs? That's kind of where our focus of how a healthy soil might be described in our research is, especially when I say inputs, I mean mostly nitrogen fertilizer in our case.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show by Wisenotics. I'm your host, Leo Bastos, assistant professor in integrative precision agriculture at the University of Georgia. Today, we welcome our guest, Dr. Chris Graham. He's a professor at South Dakota State University and manager at the same university's West River Research Farm. Chris, welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show. It is great to have you here today. I'm very excited about the topic that we're going to be talking about today. But before we start that, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are today?
Well, first off, Leo, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to speak with you today, and I appreciate the opportunity. As you mentioned, I'm a professor at South Dakota State University. I started here in 2013. And the other hat that I wear, I'm the manager of a research farm on the western side of the state. So the university is located on the eastern half of the state, about 6 hours from here. And so I'm on the other end of the state. It's a fairly different climate, much more semi-arid, different production systems than the eastern half, which tends to align much more with, you know, the corn and soybean states of the Midwest. So that's kind of my bias, I guess, in my research. As I mentioned, I started in 2013. Prior to that, I did a brief stint in Washington, D.C., and then I did my PhD at Cornell University with Dr. Harold Van Ness, focusing on nitrogen. I didn't really have any interest in nitrogen going into graduate school, but that's the project I was given, and you know, I developed that interest, and so I've stuck with that for the majority of my work as some sort of nitrogen component to it. As I've progressed through the ranks of my appointment has changed. It's gone from heavily extension to now heavily research, most 90% research, and so my focus has changed a little bit in terms of how I operate and. But still, that nitrogen has kind of been the thing that ties a lot of my work together.
Fantastic. And well, I guess I know already that you work with soil health, but could you tell us a little bit about some of the projects you're working with and just overall some of the interesting things you're looking at the moment?
So, yeah, soil health is a big component of our work. And you know, how what we're concerned with mostly is what does soil health mean for nitrogen and specifically nitrogen availability to plants. And so a lot of the work, you know, I started on the chemical side, and we did a lot of work with just nutrient cycling and focusing on mineralization and how that things like cover crops and livestock integration affect that process and making nitrogen available to plants. But late in the last, I don't know, 5-6 years, we focus a lot more on the microbiome, and trying to drill down much more into what does it mean for microbiome function? How does that component fit into the larger soil health picture? And how can we affect, you know, positive changes in that soil health, fertility, environment paradigm. And so a lot of our work focuses on, can we find microbes maybe or functional guilds that are really valuable to providing nitrogen to the plant? And as I said, you know, my work focuses a lot on small grains. So we do a lot with wheat, a bit with corn. We do a lot with pulses and nitrogen fixation as well. So that's kind of another side component, is we do a lot with rhizobia development and trying to create better nitrogen fixers. So they're two kind of disparate research components that I had try to smash together every year in my annual reviews.
Nice, nice. No, that's fantastic. So we, you know, before we get too much deeper into soil health, I wanted to ask you, can you define soil health for our audience? What should we be picturing when we think and say soil health?
You know, and we were joking before the show started, it's difficult. And you ask five people and you probably get five different definitions. And it depends on your bias, right? Where you're coming from. You might define soil health a bit differently. And of course, there are standardized definitions. I think, you know, the general FAO NRCS definition is something like the ability of soil to sustain productivity and diversity and environmental services. But now you got, you know, four words I just used in there that you need to define that again. So that's where it gets really tricky. But I think so soil health is the ability to maintain long-term productivity in a very simple sense. But from a soil's perspective, we also want to say, well, a healthy soil also cleans up your water and it reduces toxins and things like that too. So really hard to define. Where we are focusing soil health is what does a healthy soil do to reduce our external inputs? That's kind of where our focus of how a healthy soil might be described in our research is, especially when I say inputs, I mean mostly nitrogen fertilizer in our case.
Perfect. And I think just to follow that up, you know, and perhaps this question is even more difficult, or maybe not. I don't know. I guess I'll go ahead and ask, and then I'll let you tell me. What's the a minimum set of metrics that one should look into when trying to determine if a soil is healthy or not?
Again, that's all been defined pretty well within our governing agencies. And the Soil Health Institute's come out with a lot of different, you know, you have your components are the chemical, the biological, and the physical. And then we have different metrics for each of those. The biological, in my opinion, tends to get minimized in many cases. And it's been a focus, and it's probably just been because it's just a relic of our research abilities, right? We're much stronger for many years with the chemical and the physical assays and things that we can do, whereas the biological side is slowly coming online. So for example, what applies to our research is what we want to do is take some of those that are broadly available. And I'll give you an example of the ACE protein, which is the citrate autoclavable protein. So it's an organic nitrogen source. And maybe this could be, and then this is available at a lot of, you know, a lot of commercial soil labs. Does this, or POX is another one, permanganate oxidizable carbon. Are these indicators that we can apply to, say, a soil to say, is there values that a soil may or may not respond to fertilizer application? So that's a big question for us, because, you know, historically we focus, and my work has done a lot of this, is we go out and we put nitrogen rates, you know, a set of whatever, 4, 5, 6 rates, and we see where is the best spot on that curve. And then we spend endless amount of time trying to figure out what's the best nitrogen rate. But I always thought that's a little bit cart before the horse. Like, what, maybe we should see, does the soil actually need nitrogen? Which in most cases it will, but how responsive is that soil to that nitrogen? And we can tell that, you know, well, you can get a basic productivity per pound of nitrogen, for example. And out here in this semi-arid you know, plains where I am, it takes a lot more nitrogen to make a bushel of wheat than it does, you know, farther east where there's more water. And so your a pound of nitrogen is not treated the same in all over the country. And so can we use some of these soil health indicators to say, yes, you have this threshold? And the first question, yes, applying nitrogen will be beneficial to you as the farmer, because we think there's going to be a significant response. Or B, you know, maybe it's not so responsive. And that's where the soil health definition may come in handy, is to say a really healthy soil could probably supply most of its nitrogen that it needs. And so it's not responsive, you know. So I think our interest has really been in, can we identify non-responsive soils? Because that's kind of where we want to go with our soil health discussion, is if we're going to say or put all this time and money into creating healthy soils, let's start pushing those soils a little bit harder and asking more of our soils, rather than just putting out all our nitrogen rates and seeing where, you know, what is the best rate. I think we can incorporate some of these other factors within that framework, I guess.
Absolutely. And this is so interesting because, you know, of course, I'm not familiar with the South Dakota recommendation system for nitrogen in different crops, but, you know, sometimes depending on the state, you may have just one general formula for determining, normally based on yield goal and mass balance, that may not be taking into account this diversity in environments within the state that itself is impacting soil health either directly or indirectly. And then you have the soil health itself coming into play and then also interacting with nutrient management. So that's a really, really interesting take. And well, so my question to perhaps follow up or maybe complement what you just said is, how does soil health impact your nitrogen fertilizer rates? What have you been seeing through your research on this overlapping area between soil health and nitrogen rates?
And so, you know, I brought up two examples, the ACE and the POX test, which I specifically, because we do find where you have higher ACE values, you get less responsive soils to nitrogen, which makes sense, right? Because the ACE protein is thought to be a proxy for the nitrogen that will become available over the growing season or over a period of time that the plant can take up. So if you have a healthy soil that's turning over that organic nitrogen, you know, that would supplement or supplant, you know, your need for nitrogen fertilizer applications. And so, you know, we find that that's a reasonable indication of both response to fertilizer, but also fertilizer uptake. We kind of find we use a lot of N15 isotopes with this, and so we can kind of track how much of our applied nitrogen is getting into the grain, for example. And so, as you'd expect, a less responsive soil may only take up 10 or 15% of the fertilizer that we apply. But yields are still pretty, you know, we define a non-responsive soil as it's not statistically different at your different nitrogen rates, right? So the yields are keeping up, but the fertilizer is not used. And so some of this, you know, we think that these could be useful. We use a lot of other indicators like enzymes, beta glucosidase and beta glucosaminidase are a couple. Urease is another that these are all highly autocorrelated, you know, and so one could serve as an indicator for all of these, but they all kind of give you the same positive, or it would be a negative correlation. The higher those values, the lower your response is.
Perfect.
And then one of the things that we're kind of interested in is diving deeper into, so what are the microbes that are really doing this? You know, that's the product, but it's still the microbes that are producing those enzymes and doing the work. And so we're trying to build kind of a core biome to say, these are the players that we want to focus on. And if we can find easy indicators for those, you know, maybe those are other ways that we can use to say, okay, we got a pretty good roster of microbes in your soil. And we think, you know, you could probably back off your nitrogen fertilizer.
So something that I think, I'm sure growers think of is, of course, most growers are not running nitrogen rate trials with multiple rates to determine what would have been the best, right? They just go with the rate that they get at their rate using some type of algorithm or perhaps just experience, right? But so if growers are not doing those trials, they may not know how responsive their soil really is if they don't have a check where they don't apply nitrogen at least, right? And so let's say in years where maybe, you know, especially like growers are going through right now with, you know, input costs being high, commodity prices being low, if a grower were to think of like, okay, maybe I have a healthy soil, I have some of these indicators saying that I can hold off on nitrogen. It's maybe it's a year that's particularly high input costs, and they just decide to, you know, significantly decrease the rate they're using because some of these indicators are showing they can do that. What are your thoughts on that approach? And at which point do you think that, okay, we've used that storage of nitrogen or perhaps other nutrient for a few years. Now we have to give back so we don't mine the soil for that nutrient, right? So how do you think about this trade-off of, okay, I have a healthy soil, I can use it to my benefit, but if I overuse it, I can also start seeing problems that were not there before?
Yeah, I think it's a really important question, because at some point, if we're not applying or if we're not recycling nutrients, we start to mine those things. And so, you know, like if you look at organic matter, a lot of times people like to use that bank account analogy that, oh, it's like a bank account. You can build it up. And we want to grow our bank account, right? And talk about there's a building phase and a maintenance phase for these different pools of nutrients or organic matter. And I think that has to be balanced, and it can't be ignored in the sense where if I'm saying, no, you don't need to apply nitrogen, you'll be good. You got healthy soils. Let's push those soils and let's use our resources. So I'm saying, let's spend some of that money you've been accruing in your bank account. So where's the line? You know, where do you say, okay, now we need to get back into a maintenance phase or a building phase? And so I really, I do kind of struggle with that, because I think sometimes there's a bit of a virtuous cycle too. If you're building organic matter, you're building your nutrient pools. If you're, you know, so things will drop and decline with each other as well. So I think, you know, I think that's really important to acknowledge, that you can't spend all the time without eventually going into the red. And so where I think those indicators, what we need to do more longer term is to see, will those indicators start to rise and fall with those changes? And that's important. So either way, you can still, you know, if at some point you can build a threshold like we do with everything, we have values for nitrogen right now. And like you mentioned, every state has kind of their own system, but it'll say, if you're below this value, you know, you're really low. If you're here, there's medium. If there's high, there's, you know, you don't need to apply. That's what they already do. And so some of these other indicators, if it's just a binary, very responsive or low responsive, at some point you can establish similar thresholds to say, well, you've been non-responsive for a long time, but now you've spent enough out of your bank account that you're back in the responsive category. So we need to start building back up. And so, yeah, I think you can do that. We don't have the confidence to say anything of that nature at this point. But I think those could also show, like, you know, and correlate that. If you said my nitrogen is, I'm at X pounds in my top 2 feet. And I look at my university guide and it says I'm in the low category, so I should apply. But if I can supplement with some of these other soil health indicators and say, you know, they also support the fact that my soils seem to be very responsive to the nitrogen. You know, I think that gives you confidence to say, well, even in a pretty competitive nitrogen market, you know, it's getting tight. I might need to think about strategically applying my nitrogen. I might, you know, prioritize field A over field B based on some of these different metrics, you know, and or even in a, you know, in a precision, you know, if you want to go that detailed, then you can start applying at a variable rate, you know, based on some combinations of things. Because even, you know, like I said, we'll see nitrogen, and even then those levels, the correlations that we see with just the nitrogen in the soil and the response to that nitrogen or the applied nitrogen is good, but it's not great. It's, you know, 40 or 50% R value. And maybe we can get that up to a 70 or 80% where the amount you apply and the response are a little more closer to that 1-to-1 ratio that or that correlation that we'd want.
Right. And you know, I think it has something to do as well with the fact that if you're relying on your soil organic matter and mineralization to provide nitrogen, it is more uncertain, right, than applying even organic, but especially inorganic nitrogen sources to the system. And so I think just that interaction with the environment, with weather and soil and management also brings this level of uncertainty that changes from year to year. It perhaps adds more noise to that signal as well, right?
Yeah, and you know, in my case, in this where we get 14 to 16 inches of rainfall per year, guess what? If it doesn't rain in May for us, then you won't get that supply of nitrogen from you won't get that flush of nitrogen from the soil. You might also argue though that if you put down nitrogen, it will just sit there because the plant's not growing anyway, you know. So it's a calculation, and there is you're trying to make your best guess. And this usually is happening much earlier in the year. And so it's kind of a roll of the dice. And out here, I think even more so in these drier areas where it is much more unpredictable. So yeah, it's not a silver bullet by any means, but if we can throw as much information at the farmer and they can discard whatever they want, that's great, but they can't discard what they haven't seen or they haven't heard. So that's always my view. They're welcome to, you know, let anything that I say go by the wayside, but at least the information is there.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, yeah, and nitrogen and weather and all the interactions with the other components of the system just make up such an uncertain piece of the puzzle, right? It's something that is just, I mean, not easy to study. That's why we keep studying it for the longest time.
Yeah, there's some job security there for sure.
That's right. All right, so my next question to you is, so you basically talked about how having a healthy soil and how indirectly how that having a soil microbiome that is functional perhaps may help you decrease your nitrogen rates eventually, not always, so you don't mine your soil. But what about the other way around? So how does nitrogen rate itself changes the soil microbiome?
Again, you know, as any scientist who is still working will say is that it depends. I think so. The biggest effects that, you know, we've observed, and of course a lot of those larger meta-analyses have shown, is that over the long term, you know, a lot of the nitrogenous fertilizers tend to decrease the diversity of the soil microbiome. And what that, you know, generally what it comes down to in many cases is it's a pH issue. You know, if you apply a lot of nitrogen fertilizer and it's not being used by the plant, it's probably going to reduce your pH, and pH is going to affect everything else. So it's just that more of an indirect effect. And so the really important question, though, is what are the changes to the, I mean, we can say, okay, the microbiome has gotten less diverse, or we've lost certain parts of it, but what are the parts that we're losing? Sometimes I say, if you have your starting, you know, football team and all of your backups get injured, that may not affect your record as much because your starters are still there. They're still in the game. But when you start losing your starters too, that's when the team really suffers. And so just to say, okay, we've lost diversity in our microbiome, that doesn't necessarily mean we've lost function. And I think that's a little bit more complicated. In any year to year, our work has shown that you don't see that. You don't see much loss of function, at least for some of the genes that we're looking at, on a very short-term basis. But over the longer term, that's a little bit harder. You know, there's a lot of work that shows, say, we're reducing some of the oxidative enzymes. So those are the ones that are involved in decomposition. And of course, that has a whole cascade of effects. But if you reduce decomposition, on the one hand, you say, oh, great, then that means our carbon's sticking around. It's not being decomposed, so we're sequestering carbon. So that's a good thing. But if you're not decomposing that carbon, you're also not getting the energy and the nutrients that are associated with that carbon. And so there's a balancing act, and there's probably 10 other factors that go into that to interact, and the magnitude and the extent of all those things, how that differs. So as you would expect in everything that we do, it's really, really difficult to answer, and it's really tricky. But, you know, I think some of that, if you could just say, well, it's just a pH issue. Okay. So just keep your pH in check. We have practices that we can do to manage pH, changes associated with nitrogen fertilizer. So maybe that's enough. Maybe, you know, that's all we need to do. And you know, the other thing is that it's not nitrogen fertilizer and microbiome disruption are not mutually, or I should say applying or not applying fertilizer is not mutually exclusive. There's a range of application rates. And I think anybody would say, well, there's probably a sweet spot that we can hit. And that goes back to, well, okay, now we're back to predicting nitrogen rates and what's the right one. But certainly if we can modulate that a bit more, then hey, that saves the farmer money. And it also has these other effects on soil health. And it's less of a gradual or abrupt shift. So I don't know if I answered your question really all that well, but yeah, I think it's really tricky. And I do want to point out though, that I don't want to say it's one or the other, you know, there's certainly a sweet spot for all for nitrogen application.
You know, I mean, you made a point that I think is really interesting just to think about as far as, you know, so if a healthy soil means that's a soil that can sustain productivity or production over time, it means that to some extent that soil has to be releasing nutrients, be it from the soil itself or from the inorganic or organic phases. But then, you know, I mean, you said something that is, it's intuitive, it makes sense, but at least I have not thought of both of them together on the same conversation as far as, okay, we want nutrient release, but we also want to sequester carbon. And those two things, at least in relation to some nutrients, there's a trade-off. It's hard to do both together, right? So that's such an interesting point to just ponder.
Yeah, and I there's a great paper in the early 2000s from it was Janssen in Canada that talked a little bit about that trade-off. And I wrestle with that a lot, because how much of our carbon should we use versus, most of our talk is how much carbon can we build? But again, if you go back to that bank account, what fun is having billions of dollars in your bank account if you never spend the money. And so I think we need to, and that's one of the great things about the carbon debate is it's starting to evolve, and we're starting to get into these mineral associated fractions versus particulate organic fractions. And we're starting to, when you start to drill down into these different fractions, then you can say, okay, these have different functions in the soil too. This is your short term, this is your long term uses. And so that's one of the areas that I think is really, really fascinating is how are these subpools changing, and which one should we focus on? Which practices affect one or the other? And then to your your point is, well, how do we decide which one we want to use, which one we want to build? And I don't have a good answer for that, of course. Well, it depends a lot on the funding cycles too, and where we want to place our goals. Do we want to sequester carbon? Do we want to spend it? I think there's a lot of different priorities from a policy level too. So,
no, absolutely. And I mean, especially for non-nitrogen fixing crops or crops that don't perform biological nitrogen fixation. We know that if you add nitrogen from outside of the system in the form of inorganic or even organic sources, you will increase your biomass production, which in turn helps to increase your carbon input to the soil, which then, there's also that component, right? Like, I mean, applying nutrients in general, but nitrogen especially, will probably help you build organic matter over time, just because you're adding more carbon to that system, right? So I think also that side of it is also interesting just to consider as well.
Yeah, and what are those carbon inputs? Do they lend themselves to sequestration potential, or do they lend themselves to more readily available? And of course, that gets into those quality, litter quality debates and things like that. But in a healthy soil, again, there's that functional component is, have we built the microbial team, to handle those types of resources? Are we biasing that microbial community to be more responsive to one input versus another? And that could be nitrogen, that could be carbon. I think, in my opinion, that is absolutely yes. The more fertilizer you put down, going back to how does fertilizer change the microbial community? Obviously, when you put a bunch of urea down, you see a spike in ammonia oxidation, or you see a spike in some of the different mineralization genes. So clearly, when you put a fertilizer down, you're biasing for the microbes that can do that kind of work, right? And so are those the ones that we want? Probably to some extent, we probably want a good balance of all of them, but that may not be the case depending on our systems and the inputs that we're providing. I think that's really cool. And when you could get into the future of it, when you start engineering these things and start maybe adding them synthetically, then it's kind of a different world that we live in, when you can start to engineer your microbiome to the outcomes that you're looking for. That stuff it's well beyond my abilities. But I think it's really, really exciting for new researchers that will discover those things.
It's time for our famous three.
WiseNetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access WiseNetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
All right. Well, if you're listening to this episode, you're enjoying this great conversation, make sure to follow us, share this episode with friends, and subscribe to our channels on social media, so you keep up to date with our our new content that is always coming out. All right, Chris, so we're getting towards the end of our episode. So we have the three questions that we ask every single guest. And the first one of them is, would you have a technical resource that you could share with us that you found to be very useful for you in your career?
The one I immediately go to is I guess at heart, I'm a soil nerd. And the book that I think of immediately is The Nature and Properties of Soils, which is, it's kind of the, one of the standard soil textbooks that you get in an intro soils class, but I still use it in my graduate classes as well, because it's such a broad, it has such broad applications, and it covers all those three. You know, we talked about the biological, the chemical, and the physical. So it covers all of that stuff and much, much more. And it's, you know, it's been around since, I don't know, it's in its 15th or 16th edition now. So it's been around since early 1900s. In fact, I found a PDF of the first edition, and it's really cool to see what they were talking about in the 1920s about soils versus what they're talking about now. And even the newest edition, you know, came out in something like 2015, 2016, and 10 years on, you know, even that's out of date, you know, and so stuff is really evolving so quickly. And so it's out of date on the one hand, but at the same time, that first edition has really foundational stuff. And so it's really neat to talk about that. And, you know, all these things are cyclical, so we'll probably be revisiting all of that in the near future as well.
That's right. And so just to make sure that our audience has the right name, so Nature and Properties of Soils.
That's correct. Yep. It's the editor is Ray Weil, but it's taken the current editor, but it's taken many. Niall and Brady, I think, was the original one. But yeah, so that's the name.
Nice. Perfect. All right. So our second question is similar to the first one, but it's a resource outside of the technical side of things. If you have one to share with us.
I struggled a little bit about on this one. I think, you know, I'm sure there's lots of great books to make you a better human and a better operator of life. But in my opinion, I think one of the most important things is to not work too. When you're not working, you should not be thinking about work necessarily. And so I'm a Sherlock Holmes fan. And so I recently downloaded, Audible has the comprehensive Sherlock Holmes, and it's like 70 hours. Of all of the Sherlock Holmes novels. And it's read by Stephen Fry, who's a British actor, and it's just like he's great character actor, and you know, the accents, and it's really wonderful. So it's 70 hours, but I bet I listened to it I don't know how many times. You can just go and listen to one story, and it's a nice reprieve from work and stress and stuff like that. So really an enjoyable listen.
Fantastic. That's great. And I totally agree with you. I think that it's good to have some time that you just disconnect so you can refresh, and maybe even some new ideas come out of a completely different source of inspiration, right?
Yeah. Just because you're not working doesn't mean you're not productive still.
Right.
So, yep.
Absolutely. Nice. Thanks for sharing that. And then our last question here is, in your opinion, through your experience, what is the skill or maybe skill set that you've observed in successful professionals around you?
Yeah, I think the people that I enjoy working with the most and I admire the most are the ones that are willing to work with me. And I say that kind of glibly, but I think in academia, I've been fortunate. I've so many people are just really excited to collaborate. And I think that collaborative spirit is really critical to, you know, cutting edge research. so much of what we do in this world is interdisciplinary, and we can't do it all alone. Even with ChatGPT, you still can't do it all. And so having these, building this network and people that really are excited to collaborate and offer their skill sets or their niche has been so rewarding for me. So I think just that collaborative spirit and excitement for things that you don't necessarily know about, you know, that spirit of curiosity, I think is really, really great. And it's always inspirational when I can see that very visually or viscerally with other people.
Nice. Fantastic. Well, thanks for sharing all that. And with this, we wrap up our episode today. Chris, thanks for being with us today. It was really, really great to hear your thoughts in this overlapping area of soil health and nitrogen management, especially. It's something that is so, so critical, so interesting. And so thanks for sharing your thoughts with us today about that.
Yeah, thank you very much, Leo. It's a pleasure for me. I really appreciate you having me on.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.